Chapter 20. Unknown to most visitors of Hong Kong are the outlying islands, 235 of them. Considered the other face of the bustling business district across from Kowloon, the old fishing villages and peaceful open countryside are embellished by picturesque farms and ancient temples. Most of the islands are less accessible than Zhengzhou, Lama, and Landau, whose populations run from 8,000 to 25,000, and many are still uninhabited. 4 miles southwest of the town of Aberdeen on Repulse Bay, Chanan Island rises from the waters of the East Lama Channel across a narrow channel from the Stanley Peninsula. It is small, no more than a mile in diameter. At its peak, jutting from a promontory 200 feet above the sea, stands a monument to wealth and power, a manifestation of supreme ego. Originally a Taoist monastery built in 1789 and dedicated to Ho Shi Kyu, one of the immortals of Taoism, the main temple and its surrounding 3 smaller temples were abandoned in 1949. In 1990, it was purchased by Qin Shang, who became obsessed with creating a palatial estate that would become the envy of every affluent businessman and politician in southeast China. Protected by a high wall and well-guarded gates, the enclosed gardens were artistically designed and planted with the world's rarest trees and flowers. Master craftsmen replicated ancient design motifs. Artisans from all over China were brought in to remodel the monastery into a glorious showplace of Chinese culture. The harmonious architecture was retained and enhanced to display Qin Shang's immense collection of art treasures. His 30-year hunt netted art objects from China's prehistory to the end of the Ming Dynasty in 1644. He pleaded, cajoled, and bribed People's Republic bureaucrats into selling him priceless antiques and artwork, any cultural treasure he could get his hands on. His agents combed the great auction houses of Europe and America and scoured every private collection on every continent for exquisite Chinese objects. Qin Shang bought and bought with a fanaticism that stunned his few friends and business associates. After an appropriate time span, what could not be purchased was stolen and smuggled to his estate. What he couldn't display because of lack of space, or was documented as stolen, he stored in warehouses in Singapore, and not Hong Kong, because he didn't trust bureaucrats of the People's Republic government not to decide someday to confiscate his treasures for themselves. Unlike so many of his super-rich contemporaries, Qin Shang never settled into a lifestyle of the rich and famous. From the time he hustled his first coin until he made his 3rd billion, he never stopped working at extending his thriving shipping operations, nor did he cease his maniacal, unending drive to collect the cultural riches of China. When he bought the monastery, Qin Shang's first project was to enlarge and pave the winding foot trail leading up to the temples from a small harbor, so that construction materials, and later his artwork and furnishings, could be carried up the steep hill by vehicles. He wanted more than to rebuild and remodel the temples, much more. He wanted to create a stunning effect never achieved in a private residence or any other edifice so dedicated to the accumulation of cultural art by an individual, except, perhaps, the Hearst Castle at San Simeon, California. It took 5 years from start to finish before the grounds inside the walls were lushly landscaped and the decor inside the temples was completed. Another 6 months passed before the art and furnishings were set in place. The main temple became Qin Shang's residence and entertainment complex, which included a lavishly decorated billiard room and a vast, heated indoor-outdoor swimming pool that meandered in a circle for over 100 yards. The complex also sported 2 tennis courts and a short 9-hole golf course. The other 3 smaller temples were turned into ornate guest houses. In the end, Chin Chang called it the House of Tin Hao, the patroness and goddess of seafarers. Chin Chang was an extremist when it came to perfection. He never ceased fine-tuning his beloved temples. The complex seemed in a constant state of activity as he redesigned and added costly details that enriched his creation. The expense was enormous, but he had more than enough money to indulge his passion. His 14,000 art objects were the envy of museums around the world. He was constantly besieged with offers by galleries and other collectors, but Chin Chang only bought. He never sold. When completed, the House of Tin Hao was grand and magnificent, looming over the sea like a specter guarding Shang's secrets. An invitation to visit the House of Tin Hao was always accepted with great pleasure among Asian and European royalty, world leaders, society people, financial tycoons, and movie stars. Guests, who generally arrived at Hong Kong's international airport, were immediately flown by a huge executive helicopter to a landing pad just outside the temple complex. High state officials, or those of a special elite status, were carried by water on Chin Chang's incredible 200-foot floating mansion, actually the size of a small cruise ship, which he designed and built in his own shipyard. Upon arrival, the guests were met by a staff of servants who would direct them to luxurious vans for the short drive to their sleeping quarters, where they were assigned their own private maids and valets during their stay. They were also informed about dinner schedules and asked if they preferred any special dishes or particular wine. Properly awed by the scope and splendor of the rebuilt temples, the guests relaxed in the gardens, lounged around the swimming pools, or worked in the library, which was staffed with highly professional secretaries and specially equipped with the latest publications, computers, and communication systems for businessmen and government officials, so they could remain in convenient contact with their various offices. Dinners were always formal. Guests gathered in an immense antechamber that was a lush tropical garden with waterfalls, reflection ponds filled with vividly colored carp, and a light perfumed mist that filtered from jets in the ceiling. Women, to protect their hairstyles, sat under artistically dyed silk umbrellas. After cocktails, they gathered in the great hall of the temple that served as a dining room and sat in massive chairs exotically carved with dragon legs and armrests. Flatware was optional. Chopsticks for Oriental guests, gold-plated utensils for those used to Western tastes. Instead of the traditional long rectangular table with the host seated at its head, Chin Chang preferred a huge circular table with the guests comfortably spaced around the outer circumference. A narrow aisle was cut in one section of the table, so gorgeous, svelte Chinese women in beautiful form-fitting silk dresses with thigh-high slits in the skirts could serve a multitude of national dishes conveniently from the inside. To Chin Chang's creative mind, this was far more practical than the time-honored method of serving over a guest's shoulder. After everyone was seated, Chin Chang made his appearance in an elevator that came up through the floor. He usually wore the expensive silk robes of a Mandarin lord and sat on an ancient throne elevated 2 inches above the chairs of his guests. Irrespective of status or nationality, Chin Chang acted as if every meal was a ceremonial occasion and he was the emperor. Not surprisingly, ranking guests loved every minute of a stylishly staged dinner that was actually more of a feast. After dinner, Chin Chang led them to a lavish theater where they were shown the latest feature films flown in from around the world. They sat in soft velvet chairs and wore earphones that translated the dialogue into their native language. By the end of the program, it was close to midnight. A light buffet was laid out, and the guests mingled among themselves while Chin Chang would disappear into a private sitting room with a selected guest or two to discuss world markets or negotiate business deals. This evening, Chin Chang requested the presence of Zhu Quan, the 70-year-old scholar who was China's most respected historian. Quan was a little man with a smiling face and small, heavily lidded brown eyes. He was invited to sit in a thickly cushioned wooden chair carved with lions and offered a small Ming Dynasty China cup of peach brandy. Chin Chang smiled.
I wish to thank you for coming, Zhu Quan.
I am grateful for your invitation, Zhu Quan replied graciously. It is a great honor to be a guest in your magnificent home. You are our country's greatest authority on ancient Chinese history and culture. I requested your presence because I wanted to meet you and discuss a possible venture between us.
I must assume you want me to do research.
Chin Chang nodded.
I do.
How can I be of service?
Have you taken a close look at some of my treasures?
Yes, indeed, answered Zhu Quan. It is a rare treat for a historian to study our country's greatest artworks firsthand. I had no idea so many pieces of our past still existed. It is thought many of them were lost. The magnificent bronze incense burners inlaid with gold and gemstones from the Zhou Dynasty, the bronze chariot with life-size driver and four horses from the Han Dynasty.
Fakes! Replicas! Chin Chang snapped in a sudden display of torment. What you consider masterworks of our ancestors were recreated from photographs of the originals. Zhu Quan was astonished and disillusioned at the same time.
They look so perfect. I was completely fooled.
Not if you had time to study them under laboratory conditions.
Your artisans are extraordinary, as skilled as those 1,000 years ago. On today's market, your commissioned works must be worth a fortune.
Chin Chang sat heavily in a chair opposite Zhu Quan.
True, but reproductions are not priceless like the genuine objects. That is why I'm delighted you accepted my invitation. What I'd like you to do is compile an inventory of the art treasures that were known to exist prior to 1948, but have since disappeared.
Zhu Quan eyed him steadily.
Are you prepared to pay a great sum of money for such a list?
I am.
Then you shall have a complete inventory, itemizing every known art treasure that has been missing in the last 50 to 60 years by the end of the week. You wish it delivered here, or at your office in Hong Kong?
Zhi Shang looked at him quizzically.
That is quite an exceptional commitment.
Are you sure you can fulfill my request in so short a time?
I have already accumulated a detailed description of the treasures over a period of 30 years, explained Zhu Quan. It was a labor of love for my own personal satisfaction. I only require a few days to put it in readable order. Then you may have it, free of charge.
Oh, that is most gracious of you, but I am not a man who asks for favors without compensation.
I will accept no money, but there is one provision.
You have but to name it.
I humbly ask that you use your enormous resources in an attempt to locate the lost treasures so they can be returned to the people of China.
Chin Chang nodded solemnly.
I promise to use every source at my command. Though I have only spent 15 years to your 30 on the search, I regret to say I have made little progress. The mystery is as deep as the disappearance of the bones of the Peking man.
You have found no leads either? Inquired Zhu Quan.
The only key to a possible solution my own agents have turned up is a ship called the Princess Do Wan.
I remember her well. I sailed on her with my mother and father to Singapore when I was a young boy. She was a fine ship. As I recall,
She was owned by Canton Lines. I searched for clues to her disappearance myself some years ago. What is her connection with the Lost Art treasures? Shortly after, Chiang Kai-shek looted the national museums and plundered the private collections of our ancestors' art treasures. The Princess Do-wan sailed for an unknown destination. She never reached it. My agents have failed to trace any eyewitnesses. It seems many of them also disappeared under mysterious circumstances. No doubt lying in unmarked graves, courtesy of Chiang Kai-shek, who wanted no secrets about the ship to leak to the communists. You think Chiang Kai-shek tried to smuggle the treasures away on the Princess Do-wan? The coincidence and odd events lead me to believe so. That would answer many questions. The only records I could find on the Princess Do-wan suggested that she was lost on the way to the scrappers at Singapore. Actually, a trail leads somewhere in the sea west of Chile, where a distress signal was reported received from a ship calling herself the Princess Do-wan before she sank with all hands in a violent storm. You have done well, Chin Chang, said Zhu Quan. Perhaps now you can solve the puzzle. Chin Chang shook his head dejectedly. Easier said than done. She could have gone down anywhere within a 400-square-mile area. An American would compare it to looking for a needle in a field of haystacks. This is not a quest to cast aside as too difficult. A search must be conducted. Our most priceless national treasures must be recovered. I agree. That's why I built a search and survey ship, precisely for that purpose. My salvage crew has been crisscrossing the site for 6 months, and has seen no indication of a hulk on the seabed matching the size and description of the Princess Do-wan. I pray you do not give up, Zhu Quan said solemnly. To discover and return the artifacts for display in the people's museums and galleries would make you immortal. The reason I've asked you here tonight. I wish for you to put forth your greatest effort in finding a clue to the ship's final whereabouts. I will pay you well for any new information you discover. You are a great patriot, Chin Chang. But any expectation Zhu Quan had that Chin Chang was on a noble quest for the people of China was quickly dashed. Chin Chang looked at him and smiled. I have achieved great wealth and power in my lifetime. I do not search for immortality. I do it because I cannot die unfulfilled. I shall never rest until the treasures are found and retrieved. The veil shrouding Chin Chang's evil intentions was ripped away. The billionaire was no moralist. If he was fortunate enough to find the princess and her priceless cargo, he had every intention of keeping it for himself. Every piece, no matter how large or small, would become part of a hidden collection that only Chin Chang would enjoy. Chin Chang was lying in bed, studying financial reports on his far-flung business empire, when the phone beside his bed chimed softly. Unlike most unmarried men in his position, he usually slept alone. He admired women and summoned one when he occasionally felt desire, but business and finance were his passion. He thought smoking and drinking wasted time, as did seduction. He was too disciplined for a common affair. He felt only disgust for men of power and wealth who wasted themselves with dissipation and debauchery. He picked up the phone. Yes?
You asked me to call you regardless of time of night, came the voice of his secretary, Su Zhang.
Yes, yes, he said impatiently, his train of thought interrupted. What is the latest report on the United States?
She left her dock at 7 o'clock this evening. All automated systems are functioning normally. Unless she encounters heavy storms at sea, she should make Panama in record time.
Is a crew standing by to board and to take her through the canal?
Preparations have been made, answered Su Zhang. Once the ship enters the Caribbean, the crew will re-engage the automated systems for her journey to Sungari and disembark. Any word on the intruders at the shipyard? Only that it was a very professional operation, using a highly sophisticated submersible. And my underwater security team? Their bodies have been discovered. None survived. Most appear to have died from concussion. The patrol boat was found at the Harbor Authority dock, but the crew has vanished. The Iranian-registered freighter that was moored nearby the shipyard, has she been boarded and investigated? Her name is the Oregon. She departed slightly ahead of the United States. According to our sources at Naval Command, it was overtaken at your request by Captain Yu Chen of the cruiser Chengdu. His last message said that the freighter had heaved to, and he was sending a boarding party of Marines to inspect her. Nothing from Captain Yu Chen since then? Asked Chin Chang. Only silence. Perhaps his boarding party found incriminating evidence, and he has seized the ship and disposed of the crew under strict secrecy. No doubt that is the situation, agreed Su Zhang. What else do you have for me? Your agents are also questioning the guard at the main gate, who claimed that three men, one of them wearing the uniform of a security officer, presented stolen credentials and entered the shipyard in a Rolls-Royce. It was thought they drove directly to the United States. But this cannot be verified, since all guards were ordered off the dock just prior to her sailing.
I want answers, Chin Chang said angrily. I want to know what organization is responsible for spying on my operations. I want to know who is behind the intrusion and the deaths of our security people.
Do you wish Pavel Gavrovich to head up the investigation? Asked Su Zhang.
Chin Chang thought a moment. No, I want him to concentrate on eliminating Dirk Pitt.
At last report, Pitt was in Manila.
The Philippines? Chin Chang said, his composure slipping away. Pitt was in the Philippines, just 2 hours away from Hong Kong by air? Why wasn't I told of this?
Word only came in from Gavrovich an hour ago. He trailed Pitt to a dockyard in Manila, where he and his partner, Albert Giordino, were observed being taken aboard an Iranian cargo ship.
Chin Chang's voice became quiet and vicious. The same Iranian freighter that stood off the United States?
A positive match has not yet been confirmed, said Su Zhang. But every indication suggests that they are one and the same.
Somehow Pitt is mixed up in this affair. As the National Underwater and Marine Agency's Special Projects Director, it stands to reason he can operate and pilot a submersible. But what possible interest can Numa have in my operations?
His involvement at Orion Lake appears to be accidental, said Su Zhang. But perhaps he is now working with another United States investigative agency, such as the INS or CIA.
Very possible, said Chin Chang, the latent hostility reflected in his voice. The devil has proven far more destructive than I ever conceived. A few seconds passed in silence. Then he said, Inform Gavrovich that he is to be given full authority and an unlimited budget to uncover and stop any covert operation against Chin Chang Maritime.
And Dirk Pitt?
Tell Gavrovich to postpone killing Pitt until he returns.
To Manila?
Chin Chang was breathing quickly, his mouth a thin white line. No. When he returns to Washington.
How can you be sure he'll go straight to the American capital?
Unlike you, Su Zhang, who can read people from photographs. I've studied the man's history from the time he was born until he devastated my operation at Orion Lake. Trust me when I say he will return to his home at the first opportunity.
Su Zhang shuddered slightly, knowing what was about to come. Are you speaking of the aircraft hangar, where he lives with his old car collection?
Exactly, Chin Chang hissed like a serpent. Pitt will watch in horror as his precious automobiles go up in flames. I may even take the time and watch him burn with them.
Your calendar does not put you in Washington next week. You're scheduled for meetings with your company directors in Hong Kong and government officials in Beijing.
Cancel them, Shang said with an indifferent wave of one hand. Set up meetings with my friends in Congress. Also arrange a meeting with the president. It's time I soothed any misgivings they might have about Sungari.
He paused, and his lips tightened in a sinister smile. Besides, I think it appropriate that I be on hand when Sungari becomes the premier shipping port in North America.